All right, welcome back, folks. If I could ask you all to take a seat, we're going to go ahead and get started. We would like to take this time to thank our generous sponsors at the School for Successful Ranching for their support of this program and commitment to producer education. They have small displays set up in the hallway on this floor, and we ask that you visit their booths in the expo and say thank you. We couldn't have done this program without them. Our sponsors include Capital Farm Credit, Cattlemen's Education Series, Cortiva, Houston Livestock Show and Rodeo, Lone Star Ag Credit, Positive Feeds, Raybo Agrofinance, Stay Tough Fence Manufacturing, and Texas Beef Quality Assurance. Our next presentation is Utilizing Technologies to Enhance Beef Cattle Reproductive Efficiency, presented by Dr. Lamb, Dr. Cardozo, Dr. Cook, and Dr. Poehler, with the Texas A&M University. Please join me in welcoming our speakers.
Well, howdy. It's good to be here and good to get a chance to share with you some of the advances we have in reproductive physiology. For those of you that don't know me, I'm Cliff Lamb. I'm the Department Head of Animal Science at Texas A&M, and what we wanted to do here is share with you some of the latest in reproductive technologies. You know, we often read in popular press, you read about different processes in reproductive technology, and the thing that we don't often realize is what gets us to this point and the science that goes behind getting us to a certain point. You might read about artificial insemination or pregnancy diagnosis, or you might hear terms like fetal programming. And so what I thought I would like to do is have some of the folks that are actually working on the basic science and working on that science that end up in an end product that we can go out there and use as cattle producers. And so we have an opportunity here with three speakers that we're going to get to talk about this today. They're going to talk for about 15 minutes and then hopefully open it up for questions, and so that you guys can ask any questions you might have with regards to reproductive technologies out there. The ultimate goal, though, is that everybody leaves here today with one or two things that they can take back to their operations in some way and say, oh, that's something I need to think about, whether it's a concept or a production method or something along those lines. And so if we do that, then we've done our job. And so I'm going to start this off by first inviting Dr. Kai Poehler up. And Dr. Poehler is fairly new to our department. He's a reproductive physiologist, grew up in Texas, but got his PhD at the University of Missouri, worked at the University of Tennessee for a period of time, and we're lucky enough for him to come back and speak to us. And he's going to talk about factors associated with pregnancy loss in beef cattle. Thank you, Kai.
All right, howdy. Thanks for that introduction. So today I'm going to talk a little bit about getting started here. I'm going to try to stay on time, so hopefully this floor doesn't fall out from underneath me when I hit my 15 minutes. But talk about factors associated with pregnancy loss, and really as we talk about implementing reproductive technologies in our beef herd, to make sure that we remember that, you know, there's going to be associated losses that come along with that. So just highlight some of those and some of the factors that might go into affecting some of that loss. If we think about fertility in beef cattle, it's quite high compared to our colleagues in the dairy industry. If we go into a group of animals and we look at fertility to a single service where the situation is optimal, the cow ovulates, there's absolutely no problems within the system, what we'll find is that 95% of the time, fertilization and fertilization rate will be quite high in beef cattle. So that means the cow ovulates, sperm meet the egg, you have fertilization, you have an embryo-like structure that's there on day 7. Now, when we get out to day 28, which is around the first time that we can do commercial-based pregnancy diagnosis in today's market, there's a 25% loss that occurs. So down here, we're at day 28 at a 70% pregnancy rate. This 25% loss is characterized as early embryonic loss. So there's a lot of factors that have been associated with this, all the way from asynchrony of the uterine environment, heat stress-based factors, a number of different things. But one of the main things that happens during this period is that the embryo needs to signal to the maternal environment that, hey, I'm present, I'm here. Don't go through another estrous cycle and undergo embryonic mortality. Now, as we go out from day 28, so we do that first pregnancy diagnosis, and we come back and we evaluate our final pregnancy diagnosis, sometimes at the end of the breeding season. I have day 42 here as an example, day 42, day 60, day 100. What we'll find is that there's an additional 8% loss that occurs that's characterized as late embryonic loss. After about day 60 of gestation in beef cattle, unless you have some insult based on a disease prevalence within the herd, pregnancy loss is quite low. In one unique situation, that's not, and that's in vitro fertilized embryos, which I'm not really going to talk about today. But day 42, day 45 is sort of that safe point to get those embryos to go to term. Now, the reality of it is, from a research point of view, from about day 17, day 18, forward throughout this period of pregnancy loss, we have a very poor understanding of what drives pregnancy loss and what causes it. And so I just want to talk a little bit about that today, because one of the things is you can look at these numbers and say 25% is a lot higher than 8%, and that's true. But if we think about the financials behind these two sets of losses, one thing that happens in this period right here is these cows are going to cycle back around, get bred back in the same breeding season. These cows get out to about day 40 of gestation, lose their pregnancy, takes them a period of time to recycle back around. Most of the time, they're not going to conceive back in that same breeding season. Or if they do, it's going to be really late in the breeding season. So financially, this 8%, when you model it, actually costs more than this 25%. And here's a reproductive physiologist example of the math behind that. So why does it matter? If we do fixed-time artificial insemination, and we look at cows that conceive to that, and we consider that day of calving as zero, so they're going to calve the first day of the calving season, we have early embryo loss, that's that 25%, so those cows undergo early embryonic loss, recycle back around, get bred back in the same breeding season, so those calves are at least going to be 21 days behind. We take that 8% loss, they lose their first pregnancy, they recycle back, get bred in the same breeding season. Those calves are at least 60 days behind. And then you have the cows that undergo pregnancy loss and never conceive again in that same breeding season. Here's the weaning weights of those calves. I just did a times 2 pounds per day. So these calves here are going to be less 42 pounds. These calves less here, 120 pounds. And then we don't wean anything here, so minus 550 pounds. Multiply by whatever calf value you want. The important thing is that you can definitely see here as we go throughout time, the differences in how pregnancy loss affects our profitability. Okay, this is a very simplified example. If you look at it in financial modeling, it holds true. Why does this matter? Well, they all cost the same to maintain. Okay, so the question is, what drives pregnancy loss? How can we minimize these situations? How can we get more of these cows that conceive early in the breeding season to go on to have a successful pregnancy? So the first thing I want to talk about is the maternal side, the cow side factors that drive pregnancy loss. And the first thing that I want to highlight is genetic losses. So genetic losses are obviously going to come from both the male and the female side, but I'm talking about it here more on the maternal side today. And if we look at the estimates behind what genetics and genomics bring to pregnancy loss, it's somewhere in about the 10 to 15% area, all right? Depending on the situation, depending on if you're doing crossbreeding, et cetera, you're going to decrease some of that. But genetic abnormalities, obviously one of the most common ones that we think about is lethal genes. So when we have a specific mating between a cow and a bull where those genes aren't compatible with each other, you might actually get fertilization, the embryos might look normal, but you don't go on to have a successful pregnancy. So that's one of the most common. Others are genetic mutation, chromosome number, polyspermy, inbreeding and fetal losses. All these are examples of genetic losses. We're learning a lot about genetics and genomics, and obviously in the area that we're in today. One of the things that I want to point out is that there is some data that fertility is decreasing in our beef populations. And this is some data that Jared Decker from University of Missouri lent to me from looking at Angus records, where we're looking at records of about 698 registered Angus bulls that indicate either a correlated response or a selection response for decreasing Angus female fertility by about 0.22% per year over the last 25 years. So this is something that we've had an interest with because of some of the things we do with pregnancy loss as we try to understand the physiology, how much of it is genetics. And it seems that there is components of genetics that are incorporated into that, trying to understand how much of it remains to be seen. So that's one example on the maternal side. Another example that I want to point out, whoops, looks like we lost the clicker. We lost everything. Yep, there we go. Perfect. All right, the next thing I want to point out is more of a physiological response. So we talked about the genetic side of things. One of the things that we do to minimize pregnancy loss and to manage fertility in large breeding projects is to look at the estrus response of cows in fixed-time AI situations. So all the projects that we do are with fixed-time AI or fixed-time embryo transfer. So we go to the farm on a given day, breed all the cows or transfer all the embryos on that given day. We don't check estrus on anything. But one of the things that we do is we utilize Estrotec patches on these cows to score the estrus intensity or the amount of estrus activity that they've had before the time of AI or before the time of embryo transfer, and correlate that with the subsequent fertility. And so the way that we score these patches is on a scale of 1, 2, 3, or 4. You can see some Bos indicus cows here wearing the patches. In this case, they're blue. But a 1 represents that 0 to 25% of the patches rubbed off. So I'm not sure if you've seen these, but it's almost like a lottery ticket scratch-off type device. As you, the more rubs you get, the more that's going to come off. Score a 2, 25 to 50. Score a 3, 50 to 75. Score a 4. You can see these are 4s here. They're completely activated. And we then combine these as sort of no estrus or low estrus and estrus or high estrus-based events. And when you look at the correlated response in regards to pregnancy rate, this is in fixed-time AI. It's the same in fixed-time embryo transfer and in normal AI as well. As patch score increases, you get an increase in the percentage pregnancy rate confirmed at day 28 of gestation. You can see the increase there. I don't have the slide in here, but you also have a decrease in pregnancy loss in these animals that have patch scores of 3s and 4s. So 50% of the patch is rubbed off, you decrease pregnancy loss. And that's also true in embryo transfer situations as well. Now, flipping gears. So that's from the maternal side. And where we lay a lot of blame a lot of times in reproductive efficiency is on the maternal side. We blame the cow for when pregnancy loss happens or she ends up open at the end of the breeding season or into the calving season. But how much of it is from the male? So how much of it is paternally driven in regards to what's taking place? So this is one of the slides that I look at quite often in regards to fertility and trying to understand fertility. And this is variance of sire fertility from a lot of matings across South America, specifically in Brazil, to Angus sires, okay? These are all different AI centers that imported semen into Brazil. This is the number of AIs per each one of those centers. This is the pregnancy per time AI. So you can see across the board here, they are all averaging in the 50% range, which is really good in these cows because about 95% of them are anestrus the day the breeding season starts. What I want to point out is, look at the, we got locked here again. Look at the variation in these sires. In this case here, 22% to 81% pregnancy rates. The averages are good, but the variance is what's killing us. So one of the things that we've been interested in is looking at how sire fertility affects pregnancy rate and pregnancy loss. And one of the ways that we do that is looking at a marker that the placenta produces, which is pregnancy-associated glycoproteins. These are the basis for all chemical and blood-based pregnancy tests in cattle, so IDEX, Bioprint, and DG29, if anybody is using any of those. And this is what they look like. You can see these cells here producing them. They come from the placenta and are produced as early as day 24 to 25 of gestation. We have looked at this in a number of different situations, but what I can tell you, as this value increases in early gestation, you have an increased success in pregnancy rate, pregnancy success, and decreased pregnancy loss. So in this situation, you can see after we got about above two nanograms per mil, you had 0% pregnancy loss in these individual animals. So what we've been looking at is, how does the male affect this? So we've been doing time AI projects where we collect blood on day 30, ultrasound on day 30 and day 100. And we've been able to classify high and low pregnancy loss sires. So these are Angus sires from the U.S. And you can see that the high loss group has about 66% pregnancy loss between day 30 and day 100. The low group accounts for about 33% of this loss between day 30 and day 100. When we look at those individual sires, You look at the low pregnancy loss sires compared to the high pregnancy loss sires in their good pregnancies. These low pregnancy loss sires perform better. The placenta is performing better compared to the high pregnancy loss sires even in their good pregnancies. And so when you boil it all down, when you look at the male side of things, if you look at it and you ask the question, if I breed to a high pregnancy loss sire, I have about twice the chance to undergo pregnancy loss. So twice the chance. So there's very much a strong male component to this. It's obviously driven through a genetic-based factor, and it's probably more than that 10 to 15% that I showed you earlier on in the talk on the maternal side. But trying to identify to minimize sire variance in fertility is a major thing that we're trying to focus on to understand. So we decrease that variance and focus more on maintaining those pregnancies. So I'll conclude with this, that pregnancy loss causes significant losses to beef operations. A lot of times we have the impression that we don't have very much pregnancy loss. But remember, 95% of the time fertilization occurs. If I put an embryo in that cow on day 7, 100% of the time that embryo is there on day 7 if I put it in the right place. So pregnancy loss is definitely occurring, and decreasing that is important. Increased early gestational PEGs leads to increased pregnancy success. The sire influences PEG concentrations and pregnancy success. This is very clear now that the sire is having a major factor in regards to pregnancy success. And also estrus and estrus intensity is related to pregnancy success. So as we think about implementing these technologies, there's a number of ways to sort of maximize the fertility in by decreasing pregnancy loss, decreasing embryonic mortality. Okay, so I think that's my last slide. I'll conclude with that. I think I stayed on time pretty close, so I'll let my colleagues burn the rest of the time. All right, thanks.
Thanks a lot, Kai. I think the one really important take-home message here is thinking a little differently about pregnancy rates. If you think about pregnancy rates in your own operation, think more about those as pregnancy survival rates, not pregnancy rates. It's the percentage of animals that actually survived past the embryonic loss stage. And so I think a really good point that Kai brought up. Second speaker is going to be Rodolfo Cardoso. Rodolfo's specialty that he's going to be talking about here is in terms of puberty and the factors that affect puberty in heifers as you're developing them. And so I'll turn it over to Rodolfo.
Thanks, Dr. Lamb. Yes, we'll be talking about puberty and heifer development. Obviously, Dr. Poehler mentioned some important aspects of reproductive efficiency in cattle, but we need to also keep in mind that developing heifers becomes really critical for successful reproductive efficiency. So just as an introduction, the typical replacement rate in beef cattle operations is around 15 to 25%. Obviously, that's going to depend on the culling rate. But it's estimated that, you know, every year, approximately 15 to 20% of the heifers either need to be developed in the herd or they need to be purchased as replacement heifers. And that's to maintain the size of the breeding herd at the same size. Very important, the pregnancy success in the first breeding season of those heifers is going to be determined by the time in which puberty occurs. In other words, if majority of your heifers are pubertal before the first breeding season, chances are you're going to have a very successful pregnancy outcome during the breeding season. However, if by the beginning of the breeding season, a high percentage of the heifers have not reached puberty and will reach puberty either throughout the breeding season or after the breeding season, then chances are the pregnancy success of the first breeding season will be below ideal. That is not only important to determine the pregnancy rates and pregnancy success in the first breeding season, but another important goal for developing replacement heifers is to allow them and put them in a position that they can conceive early in the breeding season. So one take-home message that I'm going to mention is it's very important when we're developing those heifers to make sure that not only they are bred by the end of the first breeding season, but hopefully they will conceive early so that will allow them to calve early during the first calving season, and they will have more time to recover and be able to rebreed. Keep in mind the higher percentage of the animals that are culled in a beef herd due to the reproductive failure, majority of those animals will be first calf heifers. There's a big challenge of rebreeding those animals. So we need to be successful in that first breeding season, having them conceive early in the breeding season. So here's some example data generating research. So it's In this research, 73% of the heifers that conceive to artificial insemination at the beginning of the first breeding season, they remain in the herd after 5 years, so they were still being able to rebreed every year for 5 years, and that number decreases to 43% if the heifers do not conceive to artificial insemination, even though those heifers were bred by natural service by the cleanup bulls. In other words, they fail, a high percentage of these heifers fail to stay in the herd for 5 years or more. And that is important because regardless of the timing of the breeding season and the calving season, obviously the seasonal nature of beef cattle production is very important, very beneficial to producers, but obviously that results in a greater loss if heifers don't reach puberty at the time they should reach puberty. And I'm going to explain why. So again, two major goals, reproductive goals in beef cattle operations should be for heifers to calve for the first time approximately at 2 years of age, and I will discuss what are the benefits of having heifers calving for the first time at two years of age versus 3 years of age. And obviously after that, the expected goal is that those heifers will continue to calve and produce a calf per year. That is very important. And here's why we're going to discuss about strategies to have heifers achieve puberty between 12 and 14 months of age. So this is an example of a typical operation that has a breeding season early in the spring. In this example, it's a 75-day breeding season. So the breeding season starting somewhere around April, going all the way until mid-June. Obviously, with the calving season occurring later in the fall. So in this example, if your heifers are born in the middle of the first calving season, typically, those animals will be weaned around 7 to 8 months of age, sometime in October, and that is regardless if you're developing your own heifers or if you're buying replacement heifers. So the big target will be that first breeding season here around 14 months of age. So 14 months of age is when majority of those heifers will enter their first breeding season. And one of the big problems of these heifers, obviously, is if they fail to reach puberty before the breeding season, then you're going to have all those problems that I just mentioned. You're going to have low pregnancy rate in that first breeding season, or you're going to have majority of those heifers conceiving later in the breeding season, which is not ideal. Because keep in mind, we want these heifers to reach puberty here, be able to successfully breed in this first breeding season, hopefully calve early in this first calving season here, so that will give more time for them to rebreed in the subsequent breeding season. And if they start calving early in the calving season, then chances are, year after year, they will continue to calve early, and you'll be able to maintain those animals in the herd. So we're going to talk about a lot of strategies for having heifers to reach puberty between 12 and 14 months of age. That is a critical period. And why should we aim for that? Why not allow calves to calve later for the first time at 3 years of age? One important aspect is obviously it's estimated that cows must wean 3 to 4 calves to pay for the cost of their own development. So if heifers fail to produce at least 3 calves, those heifers likely didn't pay the cost that were spent to develop those own heifers. And there are several benefits of calving for the first time at 2 versus 3 years of age. So some economic analysis, and there's been several studies doing this different analysis, and the numbers vary a little bit, but there's quite a bit of consistency showing that heifers that breed and calve for the first time at 2 years of age will produce approximately 140 kilograms more of weaned calf weight in their lifetime. So with the current market prices, we're talking about approximately $400 more per heifer if they calve for the first time at 2 years of age. That represents a 6 to 8% greater economic efficiency. And, you know, one of the concerns for some producers that I've heard is that, you know, having heifers calve so early may have an impact on the weaning weight of the calf. But there's quite a bit of research showing that regardless if a heifer is calving for the first time at 2 versus 3 years of age, their first calf is always going to be a little bit lighter weaning. But after that, the weaning weight of those calves will increase. So there's no negative effect on the development of the calves that are born out of those heifers. What are the key factors that dictate when a heifer reaches puberty? There are two very important factors. We're going to talk about genetics and nutrition. Those are two very important factors that will dictate when heifers reach puberty. So these are different group of heifers. Obviously, up here we have some Angus and Hereford heifers. Here we start having some Bosindicus influenced heifers with Brangus and Bremen heifers. So the general rule of thumb is the animals that have a larger frame will tend to reach puberty later than animals with a smaller frame. And obviously, when you start having bosindicus influencing those heifers, then those heifers will reach puberty later than straight Bostaurus heifers. So obviously, that becomes a really big problem in southern regions here of the U.S. where bosindicus influence is more prevalent. Perfect, thanks. All right, so here's just a normal distribution when heifers reach puberty. So regardless of the breed we're talking about, there is a normal distribution. So not all heifers, even though they can have the same genetic composition, will reach puberty at the same time. So that tends to follow this bell-shaped pattern or normal distribution. And one of the objectives of managing nutrition of those heifers is to shift this to the left, be able to have heifers also have this normal distribution, but shifting to an earlier pubertal development in heifers. And that becomes really critical for those heifers and breeds that are on the right side here of the 14 months. So keep in mind, 14 months is when the first breeding season will start. So for majority of the breeds on the left, Angus, Hereford, and other smaller frame Bostaurus breeds, that's usually not a big challenge. It's estimated that 90%, 95% of beef cattle producers in temperate regions in the U.S. With this type of breeds can successfully produce their first calf when heifers are 2 years of age. Obviously, that is not the same, the same situation for producers down here with bosindicus influenced cattle. So nutrition from weaning to the onset of the breeding season can impact the age of puberty is an important factor, one of the key factors dictating when heifers reach puberty. Traditionally, there's been a recommendation, a rule of thumb, that heifers should be fed to attain approximately 60 to 65% of their mature body weight by the onset of the breeding season. And it's estimated if you do that, this rule of thumb suggests that if you can accomplish that, then you're going to have majority of the heifers pubertal by that breeding season. While this can be somewhat effective for Bostaurus breeds, this approach does not consistently induce puberty by 14 months of age in bosindicus-influenced heifers. It's not unusual to have bosindicus-influenced heifers that have 750, sometimes 800, 850 pounds, and when you bring them to the shoot to determine the reproductive tract score of those heifers, you can see that there's a very underdeveloped, those heifers are still quite far from reaching puberty. So based, you know, trying to predict when bosindicus-influenced heifers will reach puberty just based on body weight can be quite deceiving and quite challenging. So, and additionally, this constant rate of body weight gain from weaning to breed is likely not the most cost-effective and efficient method to program puberty in those animals. So we're going to discuss some different strategies that can help increase the percentage of animals that are pubertal by 14 months of age. So we've done quite a bit of research in bosindicus-influenced heifers. Mike Day, while he was at the Ohio State University, has done quite a bit of this research in Bostaurus heifers as well. And it's been pretty consistent, the fact that when we wean heifers early and we feed them to gain body weight at a high rate, we have a high percentage of those animals reaching puberty between 10 and 14 months of age. Whereas if those animals are fed to gain body weight at lower rates, they will reach puberty much later, and majority of those heifers won't be pubertal before the first breeding season. So with this research, we ask a different important question is, within this whole period, when is more important, when these heifers are more sensitive to this nutritional programming? And can we explore the system, can we exploit the system in a way that actually benefits producers and can result in high percentage of heifers reaching puberty? So we've done this experiment where here we have the body weight gain of heifers from early weaning all the way to the first breeding season. We have four groups of heifers, obviously the ones that gain body weight at low rates, the group of heifers that gain body weight at a high rate in the blue line, constantly throughout this period between weaning and the first breeding season. And then we had what we call the stair-step group, animals that went through periods of high intensive rates of body weight gain and then restriction periods after that. So trying to identify within this larger window if there are some narrow windows where animals are more responsive to these effects of nutrition. So while we looked, when we checked for the pubertal status of these heifers, not surprisingly, the low-gain heifers, majority of them did not reach puberty before the first breeding season. So this is the optimal timing. This is when we want heifers to reach puberty between 11 and 14 months of age. majority of the low-gain heifers were not pubertal by the end of the breeding season. Not surprisingly, the high-gain heifers, all of them, 100% of those heifers, were pubertal before the first breeding season. So if you feed them in a constant rate, a high-energy diet, a high-concentrate diet, majority of those heifers will be pubertal. But more surprisingly, more importantly, is when we feed these heifers a stair-step diet, going through these periods of high energy intake and then restriction, we still see the same effects of diet accelerating advancing puberty in these heifers. So this is a quite interesting study showing that if you increase nutrient intake between around 6 months of age right after weaning, the positive effects of feeding a high concentrate diet are still present even if you restrict those animals after that. With the stair step two, the animals that received this high concentrate diet later, around 9 to 10 months of age, we saw an advancement on age of puberty compared to the low gain group, but not to the same extent that we saw with the stair step one. So what is the take home message of this study? Take home message is around 6 months of age, usually right after weaning or during that period of weaning, heifers are more sensitive to these effects of nutrition. So if you want to advance nutrition and have an impact on puberty, that's usually where heifers will be more responsive to that. And by alternating these periods of high energy intake with energy restriction, you can actually you can have approximately 7% overall savings in feed costs during this developing period compared to the high-gain heifers that were fed this high-concentrate diet throughout the study. So if you focus on specific windows where animals are more responsive, you can achieve similar results, decreasing feeding costs in these heifers. All right, so just quickly here to not go over much of the time, nutrition is very important. Obviously, management of nutrition is important. But variation in the course of this event is inherent in all groups of replacement heifers. So in other words, even with excellent nutritional management, it's virtually impossible or economically feasible to provide a level of nutrition that ensures that all heifers reach puberty before the first breeding season. So that's where using some hormonal technologies, particularly estrosynchronization protocols that use some type of progesterone device, can be quite effective in inducing puberty in these heifers and putting them in a position that they can conceive early in the first breeding season. So not only they can become bred and pregnant by the end of the breeding season, but it will also allow them to conceive early on that first breeding season. I won't discuss much about the endocrine effects of these synchronization protocols, but we learned that protocols that use some type of progesterone device can inhibit luteinizing hormone secretion. And after you remove that device, that can jumpstart things and induce that first ovulation to occur. I won't go in details about different protocols, but obviously the 7-day cosync placeder, which Dr. Lamb was involved on the development of this protocol, can be quite efficient. There's some other protocols that expose prepubertal heifers to longer periods with seeder for 14 days that can be accomplished with a seeder or by feeding MGH to heifers. But exposing animals for a high concentration of progesterone for a specific period, after you remove that, you have a quite great chance of inducing those animals to reach puberty. So typically, more than 80% of prepubertal heifers are induced to ovulate with these protocols. They will result in acceptable pregnancy rate in those animals of approximately 50%. And here's just some comparison. It seems like protocols that use progesterone device for longer periods, particularly 14 days, can have more benefits to heifers that are not pubertal. But the bottom line is hormonal approaches are quite efficient in inducing that first ovulation to occur. But the only problem is they are not a magic bullet. They are not a substitute for proper heifer development and nutritional management. In other words, they will induce heifers to have that first ovulation and reach puberty if heifers are in that transition period, if they're approaching their spontaneous first ovulation. However, if the heifers are in the deeper stage of an estrus, in the deeper stage of during that prepubertal development, then the chances of those protocols of working and inducing ovulation reduce quite considerably. All right, take home message. Age of puberty can have tremendous economic impact on beef production, and that is because it not only impacts when the heifer is going to produce her first calf, but also will determine the longevity of those animals in the herd. We need to be able to keep them in the herd as long as we can and produce several calves. Key strategies to advance puberty genetic selection. We didn't have time to talk about that, but there's quite a bit of genetic selection to try to improve age of puberty. Proper nutritional management, and keep in mind that nutritional management is not just those few months or weeks before the breeding season. It's from the time of weaning all the way until that first breeding season, and trying to focus particularly on those first months after weaning can be critical. And also hormonal technologies are very important tools available to induce the first ovulation to occur. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Thanks a lot, Rodolfo. And I mean, obviously, one of the big take-home messages that I think that Rodolfo pointed out is the fact that those heifers that become pregnant early in the breeding season are the females that become cows later that last in the herd a lot longer. And so I think that that's a really key thing about the impacts of puberty and impacting puberty in your herd, what that actually does to the long-term success of cows in the herd. So the next presentation is going to be Ronaldo Cook. Ronaldo is has a lot of experience in terms of evaluating the impacts of temperament on fertility, and he's going to share some of his thoughts here. Thanks, Ronaldo.
All right. Can you guys hear me well? Good deal. So appreciate the invitation to speak to you guys today. And on this quick presentation, we're going to kind of summarize some of the effects of a cattle temperament or disposition, whatever term you want to use, on reproductive efficiency of beef cattle, and that includes a little bit of puberty, pregnancy loss, and overall reproductive performance. Now, you know, just to start, what is temperament? I mean, what does it mean? And you can, like I said, you can use the word temperament, disposition, behavior, whatever you want to do. But it's basically the responses of cattle when exposed to human handling. And to us, as cattle disposition worsens, their response to human contact becomes more and more excitable. Okay. So there is some sort of a selection for temperament already in our industry, and sometimes we use the term docility. It's a heritable trait, okay, almost a 0.5 heritability, but mostly for safety reasons. It's easier to handle cattle that are more docile than cattle that are on the aggressive side. But on top of that, the productive implications of aggressive disposition are being established, and nowadays we know that cattle with more aggressive disposition, they tend to be less productive compared to cohorts with better temperament. So, to get started, how do we measure disposition? How can we do that on a... where is it again?
There's a little box there in each of those.
What box?
24.
Show me. There you go. So on a research side, and this can actually be translated to a commercial operations, how we can assess temperament. And one of them is a shoot score. Say that again. All right. How about now? No? How about now? There you go. So we can use the shoot score, and basically what we try to do is to come up with the strategies that producers can incorporate into their day-to-day operations in terms of evaluating animals for temperament when they're working cattle in the shoot, for instance. First one is the shoot score, and cattle are restraining the shoot, of course, for body weight, preg check, vaccination, whatever. We give that animal a 1 to 5 scale according to behavior, being 1, an animal with a very calm disposition, and 5, with a very aggressive disposition, okay? And it's kind of dark because of the lights, but this is weaning time, and we are processing our replacement heifers, and there is a student here evaluating the disposition of this animal in terms of shoot score. I said 1 to 5, it can be 1 to 3, 1 with a very calm disposition, 2 being average, 3 an animal that you have to open the chute, otherwise you're going to have to buy a new chute. Second measurement that we take is the exit velocity or exit score, and it's basically how fast that animal leaves the chute. And usually animals that run away from the chute, they tend to be a little more on the aggressive side because they want to get away from you as fast as possible. And we can do using some infrared sensors, the same sensors that we use for barrel racing, for instance, or a visual score, being 1, an animal that walks away, trots away, and 3, runs away. So again, the same picture, and here we have those sensors on the alley in front of the chute,
and I basically measure the velocity this animal leaves the chute, and I give a score, one being walking away, trotting away, and then running away. Okay. We try to do both scores because many times you have an animal that's so aggressive, so nervous in the chute that that animal basically freezes up, and you think it's a docile animal, but when you open the gate, just runs away. You also have the chance of having animals that are so excitable in the chute that once you open the gate, the animal is going to jump and fall. Then you kind of mess up your exit velocity. So we average both, and then we come up with a temperament score, okay? So basically, if you do a 1 to 5 temperament score and chute score, and 1 to 5 exit score, you just average both, you come up with your temperament score. The same thing if you decide to go to a 1, 2, or 3 score. On chute score, exit score, you can come up with your temperament score on a 1 to 3 scale. We focus on the 1 to 5 scale, okay, to be a little more sensitive in terms of temperament assessment. And after a lot of research, we came up with this classification here, because once you have temperament up to a temperament score of 3, again, being a 1 to 5 scale, you don't have a whole lot of production loss. Now, when you start having animals that are on the excitable side, not only you have safety concerns, but also start to lose some production as well. It's important to maintain some disposition in the herd. That's why we're not selecting for ones and twos, because we're not raising pets, we're raising cattle. Consequently, those cows or those females, they have to be able to survive out there on extensive conditions, protect their calves. And even the calves, when they go to the feedlot, they have to have some disposition on them to be able to fight for bunk space, for water, etc. So a little bit of disposition is needed for those animals to be able to survive the environments, but you don't want too much, like 3.5s, 4s, or 5s, because then you lose too much productivity. Some factors impacting temperament, sex being one of them, age, production system, and breed type. And this is what we focus on this area, not only because females are more temperamental than males, which impacts reproduction, but the more on the extensive side you are, and that's basically cow-calf production throughout the world, you start to have animals with more aggressive disposition because the contact with humans is not as frequent. And also the breed type, and of course, being the south or southeast, you have the influence of Bos Indicus cattle in our herds, and me being from Brazil, this is something that we also do in South America. Now, let's move into the impacts of disposition and temperament. And if you remember Dr. Cardozo's talk about the importance of puberty on reproductive efficiency of females, of course they have to be pubertal to be able to be pregnant or become pregnant. This is a study done with Bos Indicus cattle. The target was to breed those animals at 15 months of age, and we selected them to be replacements as yearlings, okay? So right at the beginning of the project, what we did was we evaluated animals for temperament. And those with a score below 3, we called adequate temperament. And those with a score above 3, we called excitable. So basically what we saw was that at the beginning of the trial, the excitable cows or excitable heifers were already lighter than the ones with good disposition. They remained lighter throughout the study, and the average daily gain was less, of course. The same thing with body condition score. Now, moving into their puberty attainment, what we saw was that the heifers that we classified as excitable, they reached puberty at a lesser extent compared to those heifers called as adequate temperament by the breeding season. So excitable temperament not only was detrimental to their growth, but also to puberty attainment. And we need pubertal heifers by the beginning of the breeding season so they could breed in a timely manner. In terms of cows, what we did was to measure temperament at the beginning of the breeding season, and this is a natural breeding only using Brayford cows. And again, the higher the temperament score, or the more excitable those heifers, those cows were, the less the chance of pregnancy, going from a 90% in terms of overall breeding season to 75%. Similar study with Bos Indicus cattle. This is to fixed time DI. Cows with good disposition could go up as 40, almost 50% preg rates to AI, down to 35-30% on the aggressive ones. Now, a little more comprehensive study using Angus influenced cattle. About 100 cows classified as excitable, 300 as adequate, And then we had pregnancy rates, overall pregnancy rates during the breeding season being less on the excitable cows, calving weight the same. And if you go down here to the bottom, you see that the calf body weight produced by calf, by cow exposed, this is weaning weights, okay? Calf body weight at weaning produced per cow exposed to breeding was about 35 pounds less on the excitable cows compared to the adequate ones. Consequently, at the end of the year, the cows on the adequate group brought you $50 more per cow exposed compared to the cattle on the excitable group. Looking into Boss Indica's cattle, the same kind of study setup. Looking into first AI pregnancy rates, the same thing, about a 6% drop in pregnancy rates. Calving rate, the same difference, because after the first AI, we had a second AI and then natural breeding. Look at the pregnancy loss, about 6% more on the excitable ones, 5% more on the excitable ones compared to the adequate ones. We go back to the importance of pregnancy loss on beef cattle operations. Now, when we look into weaning results, the same thing. Even though weaning weights were about the same, in this case, actually, the calves from the excitable cows were lighter. Okay. Now, going down to the pounds of calf weaned per cow exposed, this is actually in kilos. We also had a drop, significant drop in production. Consequently, the cows on this adequate group brought you about $60 more compared to the cows on the excitable group. So, to summarize, or outcomes, excitable temperament is detrimental to reproductive performance of females. Okay, it goes back to puberty, pregnancy maintenance, overall reproductive performance, and dictates overall productivity of beef operations. And this is established across breed types, going to Boss Taurus cattle, to Boss Taurus Indicus crosses, all the way to Indicus breeds. How nutrition plays a role. Usually females with more excitable disposition, they tend to be on less body condition score than the cows with good disposition, even though this is not clear across all the experiments. Sometimes we account for nutrition just to isolate the temperament effect. The physiology behind excitable disposition as part of the stress response, and we know that stress can be detrimental to reproduction. And also perhaps a genetic relationship. As cows with genes for bad disposition, they may also have bad genes for reproduction. Consequently, strategies to improve herd temperament, it's important. This is something that we have to think about and consider into cow-calf operations, okay, to benefit overall productivity. I mean, if you combine all the studies we did, an excitable cow brings you about $50 to $60 less a year compared to a cow with good disposition. Okay? And how we can do that is by thinking about using temperament as selection cooling criteria. Okay, sires with some kind of selection for docility if possible, calling those aggressive and unproductive females, but also maintaining some disposition of the herd in the herd so they can actually survive out there. Something else that we have to think about is proper handling of cattle, because we can turn an animal with good disposition into an aggressive one if we don't handle them properly, okay? So with that, that's all I had, and turning back to Dr. Lamb.
Thanks a lot, Ronaldo. And what I'd like to do is I'd like to have Kai and Rodolfo come up. We've got about 10 minutes, and would like to open it up for questions. If anybody has a question, we've got 10 minutes here to kill, and this was by design to be able to make sure we answered questions that you might have specific to what they presented today. Question. Rodolfo, did you hear the question?
Yeah, just to make sure I got it. So what are the benefits of using a progesterone-based synchronization protocol versus just using prostaglandin in prepubertal? Yeah, the effects of prostaglandin are basically lies in the corpus luteum. So we need to remember that in prepubertal heifers, they're not going to have a present CL there. So really, synchronization based only prostaglandin or even with GnRH won't be very effective or won't have any major results because, again, in a cow that is cycling, and that's the same applies for cows during the postpartum on estrus, they're not cycling. The only way that cows respond to prostaglandin is by having a present CL in the ovary. So cows that are during the postpartum period or prepubertal heifers won't respond to that. The progesterone device or MGAs, where really you can jumpstart the system and have them have the first ovulation either during pubertal transition or during the postpartum period. Yeah, that's a good question.
Yeah. So again, prostaglandin won't have any impact on getting heifer started with puberty. You will need to use something like a progesterone. Yes.
There was significant in that study. So that is a study done in University of Missouri. There seems to be a benefit. It really depends on when you're starting your breeding season, what is the percentage of heifers they're cycling. So I didn't have time to discuss, but a good recommendation is to determine the reproductive tract score. So basically go and palpate those heifers before the breeding to determine what is the percentage of them cycling. The seven-day protocol can be quite effective if majority of them are cycling. It will synchronize and will induce the heifers are not cycling as long as they're in the transition period. Now, if you have heifers that are in the deeper stage of menstruation, that are a little bit farther from reaching puberty, it seems like, at least with, based on this study, and Dr. Lamb has a little bit more experience with that, but it seems like in those cases, longer exposure, either through MGA or CEDAR, but for 14 days, seems to have a slight benefit of around 5 to 10% increase in pregnancy rates.
Correct. Question back there.
So the question was about studies that quantify the impacts of handling on cattle temperament, okay? And controlled studies that I know of is when you try to acclimate cattle to human handling to make them with a better disposition than they were originally. And the thing is, it works. You can actually improve their disposition if you expose them to human handling at early ages, okay? Let's say on a production standpoint, after weaning, if you expose your heifers to some kind of a human acclimation so they get used to you. And, you know, it doesn't have to be something very dramatic. It's just that after weaning and you select a replacement heifers, when you go feed them, just get off the tractor, horse, whatever, just walk among them. They're going to get acclimated to you. With that, you're going to have a good impact on their overall disposition and consequently their reproductive development. Okay, with mature cattle, you can't really improve their disposition because, you know, they are what they are. They know what they want, but it can make it worse, and it's easy to make it worse. It's just creating bad memories to them. So every time they come to the chute, if they have bad memories about what you did the last time they came to the chute, they're going to remember that. Stress is going to go up. They're going to be more excitable, and then you're going to have some consequences, not only in terms of safety, but also in terms of production losses. Does that clarify your question?
Yes.
How would a common rancher determine whether his bulls he were using were high pregnancy rate bulls or low pregnancy rates without having 10 years of them?
Yeah, that's a good question. So right now we are working on taking that exact technology that I showed you to genotype bulls and develop genetic markers that are able to identify whether they're high pregnancy loss or low pregnancy loss sires. You know, we feel from bulls that adequately pass BSCs, at least in a natural service situation, and that have normal, you know, semen morphology and motility, that, you know, you still have a lot of variance in their actual field fertility and pregnancy rates. And so trying to dial that in and looking at it instead of, I mean, we're looking at pregnancy rates, but looking at it in an opposite way. We're more interested in, after you have an establishment of pregnancy, why do you have these losses? Because we feel those are the most expensive ones. Currently, right now, it's not. Yeah, the technology is licensed, but there's no commercially available test.
I think that brings up a good point about looking at fertility among different bulls. There's a lot of discussion about whether one bull is more fertile than another bull, and I think sometimes we have to be very careful about making conclusions in pregnancy rates associated with bulls in each of your herds. If you're mating 20 cows per bull and one bull has significantly greater pregnancy rates than another bull, it doesn't always mean that that bull is more fertile. It's only 20 cows. And when we've done work with fertility, usually we have to get somewhere above 2,500 to 3,000 matings per bull before we can actually tell whether one bull is more fertile than another. You may have actually selected your 20 more fertile cows inadvertently, and that's why you ended up with one bull that was more fertile than another. And I think that's somewhat related to some of the work that Kaya is working on right now, is making sure that we have the numbers to be able to get the valid gene markers, right, to make sure that those are valid when we actually present those to producers.
Yeah, so in a lot of these bulls that I showed today, we have over 10,000 matings in them to Time AI, and it seems that it's somewhere around that 4,000 to 5,000 mark where they stabilize, where we don't see big swings in fertility because of the variation in the cow herd. And it's a little bit scary because if you do the evaluations at about 1,000 and then you do the evaluations again with the next 1,000, you can sometimes get a different result, which goes to exactly what Dr. Lam is saying.
Any other questions?
What about the temperament of the bull? Much more aggressive, more fight more than others.
There are, and just a few. Most of the studies were done on the female side. But if you think about the physiology of stress and sperm production, you might have a negative impact of excitable disposition and then too much stress with the quality of that sperm and consequently the bull fertility. In turn, disposition is highly correlated a bit with libido. So you don't want to be selecting animals or bulls with very extremely good disposition, otherwise they're not going to be able to breed any cows. So maintaining some disposition on the bull battery is also important. That's why that score three, that's usually what we're looking for in terms of not only cows, but also the male offspring. Independently if that male offspring is going to be, they're going to be bulls or going to go to the feedlot. It's just we're looking for 2.5s, let's say. So they maintain some disposition on them, but they're still productive.
Question.
My question for Dr. Is there, I understand your research protocol and how these cattle were evaluated. Is there any talk about how that's going to translate to the commercial cowman? Is there sort of a scale being developed where
Yeah, so when I do temperament trainings, and we try to do something a little more simple than what I am explaining here today, is looking to cows on a 1, 2, or 3 score, but the best way to do it is when you handle them in the working facilities for some kind of procedure, such as preg check, body weight, vaccination, etc. So you have them on a common ground so you can measure or evaluate temperament on them on an equal basis. So when they come to the chute, just look at the cow, don't squeeze too much, just give her a little freedom to move inside the chute, and then you do 1, it's a very calm cow, almost like a dairy cow. 2 is a normal cow, okay, shakes a little bit, she's not very comfortable in being there. And then 3 is the one that says, holy man, just let her go. That's the 3. You don't want that, okay, 2 is fine. Now, when you open the chute, then you have those cows that walk away, which is still okay, trots away, which is normal, but runs away. You don't want that. So if you combine both scores, okay, let's say that you have a cow that's 2 on the chute score and it's 3 on the exit score, she's 2.5. On a 1 to 3 scale, you only want 2 and below. 2.5 or 3 or too much on the excitable side that you might be losing production. So that's a simple way to do it, right? Some producers, they might want to do, when I go up on pasture, I'm going to see that high-headed cow in the back of the group. I bet she's going to run me over. Yeah, she will run you over. But try to determine her disposition next time you bring her to the chute, and you have a safe place to do your evaluation, and all the cows are in a similar environment. Does that answer your question? Okay. And like I said, you might say, Ronaldo, I have a cow that she's crazy, but every year she's pregnant. It's because you remember her. All the 10 crazy cows you had that were open at the end of the breeding season, they're gone. So there's no reason to keep unproductive and aggressive females in the herd. Now, you can select heifers, your replacement heifers, for disposition right away, right after weaning, and that's going to help you establishing a cow herd with good disposition.
I have one more quick question, and then I think we'll pretty much be done. But go ahead. I'll let you ask the last question.
Yeah, so there's a lot of good data, and I didn't have time to talk about it, but you want to move those cows either in the first 7 days or wait until after about 60 days. And it really goes with that graph that I showed, the first one. After you have the placental attachment to the uterus and it's formed, then pregnancy loss is drastically decreased throughout that after that period. So it sort of fits that curve that I showed right there quite nicely.
Okay, I think that's it. Let's give them a round of applause quickly.